Even as the 2008 U.S. elections have been decided, climate change remains on the front burner of discussions around the world. We'll talk with Dr. Susan Solomon of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Earth System Research Laboratory in Boulder, Colorado, about her award-winning work in the area of climate change, its causes, effects, and potential solutions. It's all on Jet Streaming from Minnesota Public Radio. Hello once again, weather fans. I'm Kathy Werzer, host of Minnesota Public Radio's Morning Edition program. Paul Huttner remains on assignment, but I'm joined in studio by University of Minnesota meteorologist and climatologist Dr. Mark Seely and Minnesota Public Radio's own meteorologist Craig Edwards. Mark and Craig, how are you?
Tired. I think everybody's been pretty excited this week.
And, yes.
Actually, I think...
I heard that there was an election.
Yeah, yeah. There was an election, and tired but exuberant. I mean, there's a lot of ground ahead of us.
That's true.
I'm exhilarated. Yeah. I just think that it's finally we got something on the weather map that us meteorologists can rub our hands together and say, we got some game going here.
Oh, about the big weather system out west.
Oh, yeah, the big weather system getting going here, Kathy.
And we'll talk about that later. We do have a full weather plate today, so let's get right to it. As you know, we've visited the topic of climate change several times here on Jet Streaming, including the 2007 report by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, also known as the IPCC. That report pointed to causes of the Earth's climate change, including the changing attributes of climate and its relationship with greenhouse gases. And today in studio, we're joined by the co-chair of one of the working groups on that report. Dr. Susan Solomon is an atmospheric chemist at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Earth System Research Laboratory in Boulder. Dr. Solomon also holds a faculty position at the University of Colorado. In 2004, she received the prestigious Blue Planet Prize for pioneering research identifying the causative mechanisms producing the Antarctic ozone hole. She's a member of the National Academy of Sciences and served as co-chair of one of the working groups for the IPCC in 2007. Dr. Solomon and her colleagues were eventually awarded the Nobel Peace Prize for their research. That prize was also shared with former Vice President Al Gore. Dr. Solomon is in Minnesota to give the 16th annual KNAST lecture at the University of Minnesota. The title of the speech is A World of Change, Climate Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow. And I'm so happy that Dr. Solomon's with us. Good to see you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
For folks who are tuning in all across the globe, because we have a listenership that does span the poles practically at this point, give us a snapshot of where we stand today in the area of climate change.
Well, that's a question that's can be answered in a lot of different ways. I guess I'll say that it's very clear that warming is unequivocal. That was one of the keystone statements of the fourth assessment, and it's been, I think, only reinforced actually recently, particularly by the retreat of Arctic sea ice, which was quite dramatic this summer, as it was last year. So clearly things are really changing in the Arctic. I think the other thing that's really interesting is the increasing evidence for changes in rainfall. So to me, where we stand is that we're evolving past just talking about temperature and it getting warmer to really talking more broadly about climate as a system, about the climate system and how it's changing. And I think as a scientist, I find that very exciting, but I also think it's important for people to understand it because it's actually rainfall, for example, has such an enormous effect on our lives. A 10% change in rainfall is huge, and it's something that farmers can understand. It's something that anyone who has lived in a dry climate like I do in Colorado can understand. So it's really quite exciting to see those new information and data coming in.
Susan, of all our guests on Jet Streaming, you, I think, represent a scientist and a perspective, by the way, that's perhaps more international than any other. Certainly, you've collaborated with a number of scientists through the IPCC as well as through your other work. Do you feel like we're in a good environment today as far as the exchange of data and the dialogue on this issue in the international arena? Can you share a perspective on that? I'm aware, for example, one reason I asked the question is internationally there are some different ways in terms of how scientists and their countries treat privileged data. But in terms of sharing the data on climate change, are there still any restrictions out there that are bottlenecks to the scientific community?
I think less and less these days. You know, in the old days, meteorological information was closely held. It was viewed as having tremendous military value. People are, I think, realizing more and more the value of sharing. And, you know, I think we find that once we get past the higher-ups and to the scientists who actually work with the data, it's not too difficult to get access to anything that you need. I'm actually doing a paper right now with some people from Argentina because they happen to have some data that I'm interested in. So there's all kinds of ways to branch out to people, and there's a tremendous network of communication between scientists.
Say, speaking of cooperation, I'm curious, with your international experience, now that we have a new president in the United States, do you see increased cooperation from an Obama administration when it comes to climate change issues?
Well, I think Mr. Obama has been very clear that he intends to take the U.S. Back to the negotiations with a very different approach from what has happened in the past. And you know, to be fair, Mr. McCain, I think, deserves some credit in that area also. He made similar statements. So I think there's the good news is there's a growing recognition on both sides of the aisle that the problem is real, and that it is caused by human activity, and that the need for the U.S. to interact with other nations in the international arena is very important. And so I think you're going to see that in coming months and years.
I'm going to get Craig into the conversation in just a minute, but first I also want to ask Chris Mooney and others have written in Science Magazine about the need, or at least the thought, that the executive branch, i.e. the president, might benefit from a science advisor as a cabinet-level post, which is kind of interesting. What do you think of that?
Well, the president at the moment has a science advisor, but he's not cabinet-level. In the past, the science advisor was cabinet-level up
Correct.
Until quite recently. I don't remember the exact year that the switch was made, but I believe it was during the current Bush administration. Yeah, I don't think there's any doubt that science is needed in this 21st century more than it ever has been. We have so many problems that have tendrils out into science, and you know, we can only benefit from having the highest quality science advice and having it at a very, very high level with access to the president. So I'm certainly in accord with Mr. Mooney's suggestion.
Craig Edwards, come on into the conversation.
Well, yeah, I want to go back to April 2006, when the Time magazine cover story said, be very afraid of climate change and global warming. And then Al Gore came upon us with his Inconvenient Truth. And in it, his report or in his studies, he said there's scientific consensus that the sea ocean temperatures will rise anywhere up to 20 feet in the next 100 years, and the IPCC report suggests anywhere from about 7 inches to 24 inches. How do you remedy that disparity? That's a pretty large disparity in what seems to be what Al Gore said was scientific consensus.
Actually, I think Mr. Gore said that there was a potential for a long-term rise in sea level of those kind of numbers, and that's not at all inconsistent with what we said in IPCC. I don't think he actually did say within the next century. He certainly did not say that in the film, and I've gone back and watched the film quite carefully. People have, I think, a lot of difficulty. It's a genuine confusion between understanding when we have a pollution problem, you know, don't the effects kind of just come along with the pollution? They don't really understand the idea that there are things in the system that react so slowly that you may not see the end product for a long, long time. And this is one of them, because you're dealing with the melting of the great ice sheets of Greenland and possibly Antarctica, the massive amount of ice that's involved, the very slow rate at which heat is transferred into that ice. Is really the issue here. Now, there is a big uncertainty, which has to do with whether the ice can flow more rapidly than you would think from sort of a simple framework. So this is something we sometimes call rapid ice flow. And the idea is that you can make just a little bit of melting maybe up on the top of the ice sheet that could maybe get all the way down to the bedrock of Greenland, lubricate the base, and just kind of, you know, serve as the the oil, the lubricant, that then means a big chunk of the ice sheet just jumps out into the sea. that is something that we don't know very much about. We don't know if it's going to happen. We don't know how fast it's going to happen. If it were to happen, it's got the potential to be fast, but we don't really have the data to say one way or the other. And certainly the bigger concern in my mind is the things that we already do understand. And what we know is that a hot ocean must expand. You know, just like when you make tea, you may notice what happens to the water in the teapot long before it actually starts whistling. The water is expanding. We're doing that to the ocean. So there's been substantial sea level rise in that way already. We know that. We know that's going to continue. We also know that Greenland will melt to some degree. How much and how fast is still a question.
Well, it's been some time since Dr. Jim Hansen says that we have a limited amount of time to start turning this around, and yet discussions continue with little action, at least at the national level, about how to remedy this and how us general population people can sort of take some actions to help mitigate what may happen with the climate over the next 50 to 100 years. So do you see any urgency developing, or is it still sort of a lot of discussions, not much action?
Well, you've asked a lot of different questions in there. So let me say that I think the biggest problem that we have is that as we go forward not doing anything, we're constantly making commitments to infrastructure that we then will probably have to live with for a long time and which will continue to emit carbon. So, you know, for example, when you buy a car today, you're probably going to keep it for 10, maybe 15 years. How many miles per gallon that vehicle gets is a commitment for future emission. The same applies to buildings. When we build buildings that don't have good insulation and that don't have the kind of solar gain and perhaps even, you know, solar heating and ways to mitigate carbon like that, we're making something like a 50 to 100 year commitment because it's the lifetime of the building now. So all of these things are reasons why every little bit that we don't do today will compound into tomorrow, and that's always been true. The question of do we have a limited time to turn around, you know, is there some kind of precipice over which things are going to then rapidly change? Again, we're in that difficult situation where that's possible, but to be perfectly honest about it, our best understanding from science is that most of what's happening is going to happen just slowly and continuously. You know, I can't say anything other than that and be an honest scientist to you. So, you know, it's one of those problems that we deal with all the time. You know, it's like people who know they need to lose weight. You know, you just always think you'll go on that diet tomorrow, and first you're going to have that one last cheeseburger, you know. And,
that's true.
And I'm afraid it's in that category. But when you say what can individual people do, I firmly believe that the consumer is incredibly important in this problem. And it is only when the consumer says enough, you know, we have to have better products available that are going to be greener. We have to have sources of wind and solar and other kinds of energy that, you know, to my mind, that's what energy independence is all about. It's actually not so much about independence from sources of energy from other countries. It's the fact that we will all benefit if we have independence in the way that we generate and use our own energy. So I'm a strong believer in the pursuit of technologies. It's clear that if we're going to reduce emissions to the tune of, say, 80% in the next 50 years, which is really what we have to do to stabilize carbon dioxide concentrations, if we're going to do that, which is a huge, huge demand, we are going to have new technologies. We're going to have stuff available that will let us make different choices. There's no silver bullet in this problem. It's a tough problem in that way, very different from the work I've done on ozone where, you know, the issue was actually pretty clean and simple. And this one, we've got a lot of silver buckshot out there, but we have to figure out how to make it cheaper and how to really bring it forward. And that means the consumer has to demand that we have it.
Susan, I wanted to ask you to share a couple of thoughts regarding your IPCC experience briefly. I was excited, or at least struck a chord with me, that you're collaborating on a paper with scientists from Argentina. One of the things pointed out, I think certainly in recent years, is our lack of knowledge in the Southern Hemisphere, our relative lack of knowledge in the Southern Hemisphere relative to the Northern Hemisphere. I'm wondering if you can share a thought. Do you think we're going to see more climate science coming from studies in the Southern Hemisphere? And then my follow-up, or my second question, is from your IPCC experience, do you see that graduate science education relative to the climate sciences is being given a relatively high priority in some of the other countries maybe that you've had involvement with? So anyway, from those two perspectives, I just wondered if you had any thoughts.
Well, you first asked about the Southern Hemisphere. Personally, I love Antarctica. It's been said about Antarctica, it's not a place, it's an obsession, and that's absolutely true for me. You know, a lot of people invest a lot of time in trying to understand what's going on in Antarctica today, and its climate is fascinating. So, but that, as you say, is kind of only a small part of the Southern Hemisphere, and there is a terrible lack of data actually across the Southern Hemisphere. But it's getting better again, like other data issues. I think a lot of people are recognizing the need to make those kind of measurements carefully now, much more so than before. So I'm optimistic, but unfortunately you can never go back and make the measurements which you had from the past, but you can certainly resolve to do better in the future. And I think people are beginning to be much more aware of that. One of the great things about IPCC is the way that it builds capacity among scientists in developing countries. It's a way of bringing people together, sharing approaches, techniques, and joint projects, which has strengthened our science enormously in both the developed and developing world, because we both benefit from that wonderful interaction. Science, this particular kind of science, is obviously very international in scope, and the fact that the international science community has been able to work together through IPCC in this way has been a huge strength. So you are definitely seeing much more interest now in developing countries, and that's important because, as everyone knows, they got a lot of people, and as those people become wealthier, they will probably do what we did, which is want stuff that emits a lot of carbon, and things like, you know, transitions from having bicycles to having cars are an obvious example of that, but also the transition from having a limited diet to eating more meat is another thing that leads to a lot more greenhouse gas emissions, which some people don't quite know all about. But it's amazing what a big effect that has. So as the developing world develops, they will be coming face-to-face with the same issues, and it's going to be very important that there's good communication between scientists. It's going to be even harder for the diplomats to agree on what's an equitable and appropriate way forward. But from a scientific perspective, one of the things I find is that the language of science is absolutely universal. You can sit people down from every continent in the world, and even if they don't speak the same language, they can look at a data set and reach the same conclusions. And that's very inspiring mm-hmm. to me as a scientist.
See, a nuts and bolts question here, and I'm sorry if it sounds a little simplistic, but you mentioned in our previous parts of the conversation about how climate change and, say, ice melt in Antarctica is a very slow process. And I'm wondering, there was a cool summer in places like Alaska. And is that a trend that would suggest a slowing of global temperature rise, or is that just a little blip on the screen?
Well, it's more a blip than anything else, I think. You know, one of the real challenges in explaining climate to people is that they shouldn't get overly excited about the latest hot summer, and equally they shouldn't get overly excited about the latest cool summer, because there are ups and downs in particular places from one year to another. Those are large compared to the overall trends. They're usually caused by patterns in sea surface temperature that just mean that the type of weather system getting to that particular place is a little bit different. Now, what that generally means is that if it's bringing more cold air to one place, it's also going to be bringing more warm air somewhere else. So that's why we really have to look at climate as an average quantity. You got to care not just about your own backyard, but about your neighbor's backyard, really, to understand this problem. Now, it is true that the last few years we have not had the kind of annual increases in temperature that we had earlier. But again, you can't just look at a single year, because you encounter things like El Nino effects. Again, changes in the ocean are so important. So you've got a sort of a modulation by all these slow processes in the ocean. But superimposed on that is very clearly an inexorable, slow background trend.
Okay, thank you. Craig?
Yeah, one of the things I get pushback on is says, okay, so the United States moves to alternative energy, and we start resolving this issue in the United States, and then, like you were saying, the developing countries, then we look to China, and we says, okay, so the United States does it, but we still got problems with our neighbors emitting these gases and increasing the greenhouse gases and contributing global warming. And then when I hear in the United States, too, it says, well, maybe we don't want to do it because it's going to cost too much economically in the short term, going to be too much of a hardship, so let's just not do anything for now. So that I think the inactivity has led us down this road that if nothing's happening while we're on this planet, then we don't need to be accountable for what's going on. And I think we got to get past that and into a mindset of stewardship rather than, you know, trying to inhibit this acceleration of global warming.
Well, I don't disagree with anything that you've said. I guess to my mind, it just sounds so terribly familiar to what I experienced in working on the ozone issue. And it wasn't always as bad as it seemed, you know. I mean, the threats there were also that if we got rid of the chlorofluorocarbons, you know, refrigerators and air conditioners were going to suddenly become incredibly expensive, and people in developing countries might not be able to afford them, and, you know, this would be so terrible. And, you know, I just bought a refrigerator, actually, and it was much cheaper than the one I bought 20 years ago. So, and it doesn't have chlorofluorocarbons in it. It's got another compound that's perfectly safe for the ozone layer. So, you know, I'm just totally convinced that what's needed is a real serious investment in technology. And, you know, the need for the country to do that, to invest in it, to recognize it, that's a key part of any way forward, I think, is paramount.
Susan, you're going to be talking this afternoon to quite a diverse public audience about...
Which would be Wednesday afternoon, by the way, for our podcast listeners.
Right. And I know you do quite a bit of this on an annual basis. Do you feel that the trend across your time doing this, that you're finding audiences relatively more receptive than they once were, say, you know, 5-10 years ago?
Yeah, I'm very encouraged by the degree to which people have actually sat down, looked at the issue, studied it, and really made a careful judgment. I think people have really advanced in their understanding. It's great.
Dr. Susan Solomon, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
By the way, Dr. Solomon is the keynote speaker at the KeyNest Lecture at the University of Minnesota. The title of her speech is A World of Change, Climate Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow. She's an atmospheric chemist at NOAA's Earth System Research Lab based in Boulder, Colorado. Yes, friends, that means that we are at the weather website of the week. Anybody have any ideas?
Hey, how about this? And it is appropriate that we have thunder still leading into our website, because we did have a thunderstorm in the Twin Cities this morning, but maybe not able to use that next week as we turn much cooler. But let's go locally, Kathy. And how about TwinCitiesAMS.org, which is a great site to encourage membership and activities in the local community of the Twin Cities to be involved with meteorology and climatology, and they're very much a supporter of what we do at Minnesota Public Radio. So great website for local weather enthusiasts, TwinCitiesAMS.org. Go there, and you can also request a speaker for to come to your activity, civic organization, for speaking on climate change or issues that you are concerned about with regard to weather.
Okay, good. By the way, we have a couple listeners with some feedback this week. One, Julie in Moorhead. Julie asks, recently we had a couple of 43-degree windy days, but one felt much colder. You folks described it as having a wind that has a real bite to it. What gives wind a bite? Or in the summer, what makes wind feel like a blast furnace? Temperature is the same, wind speed is the same, but it has a much different feel. Mark Seely, try to answer that.
Well, regionally speaking, this time of year, it's startling to us. We're not prepared,
is that what you're saying?
Exactly. We're acclimating to the seasonal change. And when a polar air mass descends on us, when we get the dry, high-latitude air out of Canada, oftentimes is it not only bringing a cooler temperature, but very, very much drier air. So I think the terminology is tied to the fact that maybe we get cold, and we get the cold with the dew point maybe in single digits or something like that. So I think that attribute, the dryness of the air, probably has a little something to do with it as well.
Okay. Now, Mike from Tucson, Arizona, is a listener, and he is talking about, obviously, he really thought that the discussion that we had about winterizing your home was pretty interesting with the gentleman who keeps his thermostat at, 58 degrees?
Yes. Right. 58.
Yes. Yeah. Well, Mike says, bravo to that man for turning down the thermostat in winter. We turn ours up in the Arizona summer to 81. It's ridiculous that one needs to wear a sweater in an Arizona building in summer. So I am all for turning down the thermostat. We were remarking after that interview about how 58 degrees, it seems just a little cold to walk around your house bundled up.
Well, certainly you'd have to be layered most of the time. I think that's what our guest was suggesting, is just use your clothes, your wardrobe, instead of the fuel.
Yeah, but could you imagine coming out of the shower?
Right.
Think about that. Coming out of the shower in 58 degree temperatures.
You'd
in your
get
home.
Dressed fast.
That's probably true, too. All right. Well, don't forget, you can always drop us a line for a question or a comment by way of the Jet Streaming webpage. It's found at MinnesotaPublicRadio.org. Well, guys, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Kathy.
Thanks, Craig.
Thanks, Kathy.
That's it for Jet Streaming. For Mark, Craig, Paul, and producers Jim Bickle and P. Ray Rudolph, and sound guy Scooter Hibzinski, I'm Kathy Werzer. Thank you for listening, and remember to keep an ear here to Jet Streaming and your weather eye on the sky.